Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee, whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.
Axis Mundi.
On the surface, it was a celebration of American multiculturalism, an observance of India Day in September 2022, marking the Indian nation's 75th anniversary of its independence from British colonialism. In Edison, New Jersey, where there's a large Indian American population, there was a parade that included Bollywood actresses, lots of saffron-colored clothes and banners, and Indian flags. It was all sponsored by the local Indian Business Association. It had all the hallmarks of a quintessential celebration of American immigrant pride and honoring the variety of cultures and ethnicities represented within the U.S. But then came the bulldozer. Unlike a lot of bulldozers you see in parades, this one wasn't just there to thrill the five-year-olds. Some people called it a dog whistle. Others said it was a symbol of hate. One Muslim group put out a statement calling the bulldozer, quote, an intimidating and divisive symbol meant to represent Islamophobic and hateful messaging that has no place in New Jersey, end quote. You see, this yellow bulldozer with signs celebrating the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was a symbol of a struggle, an oppression going on halfway around the world in India. This struggle pits the Indian government-aligned Hindu nationalist majority against the Muslim minority. And one of the practices of the Indian government of the time was bulldozing the homes of Muslims who chose to protest or otherwise resist the increasingly authoritarian regime. The bulldozer in the New Jersey parade was a symbol of Hindu pride and Hindu power, a middle finger to the local New Jersey Indian Muslim community. It was also a sign that Hindu nationalism is not some strange reality contained over there in India. Somehow, Hindu nationalism is American, too.
Welcome to American Unexceptionalism. I'm Matthew Taylor.
And I'm Susie Hayward. This is the show where we ask what Americans can learn from those who have resisted religious nationalism and authoritarianism around the globe.
We interview scholars and activists about the strategies they used and the lessons they learned in their fight against oppressive religious regimes.
The United States is facing a very serious Christian nationalist threat to democracy. But we aren't alone in this fight. It's time to put our American exceptionalism behind us to learn how to create a future for all of us. Today, we will be learning about the rise of Hindu nationalism in India and its connection to current Prime Minister Narendra Modi. When you think of Hinduism, you may think of mantras, yoga, sadhus, colorful gurus. In the West, Hinduism is often packaged and presented as a source for our own potential spiritual enlightenment and well-being. It's that presentation that has driven the rise of the yoga industrial complex in the U.S. And in pop culture, you might think of the Beatles studying transcendental meditation in India, or Alanis Morissette's hit song Thinking India for facilitating her self-actualization. All this feeds this idea of India in Hinduism as an answer to our spiritual ills.
But if you were to ask a Muslim or a Christian or a Sikh or a lower caste person or a woman in India today, they might offer a very different picture of their experience of Hinduism as a dominant political force. They might tell you of a form of Hinduism that is a source of threat to their self-actualization, a source of violence, a force eroding their democratic protections. They would be telling you about Hindu nationalism and its role in India's recent democratic backsliding.
Historically, India has played a hugely significant role as the birthplace of several major world religions. Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Jainism. It rightly takes pride in being the source of so much religious and philosophical innovation in world history.
India also takes pride in its oft-cited claim to being the biggest democracy in the world. As we'll learn, its first leaders, after independence from colonial rule by Great Britain, intentionally built India as a secular democracy, creating a constitution that would not privilege any one religion, but would foster and protect its vast religious diversity.
But today, the biggest democracy in the world is under threat. Prime Minister Modi and his Hindu nationalist allies are threatening India's secular governance. They're eroding minority rights and cracking down on independent media and oppositional journalists, civil society activists, and public intellectuals. For example, the award-winning and globally renowned author Arundhati Roy, who's one of my own personal favorites, the God of Small Things, just blew my 18-year-old mind and world wide open when I first read it. Well, Roy's books have been banned in certain parts of India, and she's currently being charged under anti-terror laws for her criticism of Modi's policies.
Our guests this week are Nikhil Mandalaparthi, formerly with Hindus for Human Rights and currently pursuing his PhD at Emory University, and Anantanand Rambachan, an emeritus professor of religion at St. Olaf College. As we get started, Anant and Nikhil, this is probably going to be a bit of a daunting question because we're talking about a very large country with a very large population and a very important history. But could the two of you attempt at least to give us a very brief history of the modern nation of India? Nikhil, why don't you get us started?
So India today is the largest country in the world by population. Most states in India individually are equivalent to major countries around the world. And so before we even get into the history of India, I usually like to just emphasize what is happening right now in India, therefore is of big consequence to everyone everywhere. The modern India that we know of emerged in 1947 when the British left the subcontinent, which they had been ruling for over 150-200 years before. The modern region that we call South Asia was all British India, and in 1947 it was split into the modern nation states of India and Pakistan. There was, in that lead up to independence and the British leaving, there was a lot of debate and discussion about what an independent South Asia would look like without the British and what it meant to be Indian and to be from that part of the world. There were many different ideas of nationhood and identity swirling around in the subcontinent. What ended up happening was that the subcontinent was divided along religious lines when the British left. And so the Hindu majority areas of the subcontinent, for the most part, became what is the modern nation state of India, and then the Muslim majority areas of the country became Pakistan, which was then East Pakistan and West Pakistan. East Pakistan later became Bangladesh in 1971. And so India emerged in this moment of fracture, which we call partition. For many Indians who lived in the northern and eastern parts of the country, partition was a time of incredible upheaval and trauma. It was one of the largest forced migrations in world history, around 14 to 15 million people, mostly in the regions of Punjab and also in Bengal, basically almost overnight, in a very short time scale, uprooted their lives and moved over to one country or another. So many Muslims in modern India moved to Pakistan. Many Hindus and Sikhs in modern Pakistan moved over to India. So it was a time of incredible chaos and violence. And it's also what is celebrated as independence.
So at that time, India, led by people like the first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, and of course, Mahatma Gandhi, made an important choice. Pakistan adopted the model of the Islamic theocratic state, and India opted for a secular democratic state. But we always have to keep in mind, when we speak of Indian secularism, that it is not the same as secularism understood in Europe, in France, for example. It does not seek to marginalize or separate religion and the state, but it subscribes to the ideal of the state treating all religions equally.
In 1947, India made, like Professor Rambachan mentioned, an important decision to not be a Hindu state, a Hindu religious state, but to be a secular state. But that decision was not like uncontroversial even at that time. And from even before then, but especially when India emerged as a secular state, there's always been also this undercurrent of resentment from the Hindu right, the Hindu nationalists, who felt that that moment of independence was a moment of betrayal, and that if Muslims get to have their own state as Pakistan, then Hindus should have been able to declare, you know, their own Hindu homeland as well as India. And so the assassination of Gandhi, not even, you know, a full year after India's independence in 1940, by a Hindu nationalist who believed that Gandhi was too soft on Muslims and was really, this man Nathuram Godse was a Hindu nationalist who believed that independence was a betrayal of the Hindu nationalist kind of vision of a Hindu state, Hindu homeland. And so, you know, from the moment of independence, there's a segment of the population who believes that that was not right, that India should be a majoritarian state. And then what we are seeing now is that segment has captured power and has been in power for, you know, over a decade now.
This is very helpful history, and I just want to note, because this is something that is recurring throughout our series, when we talk about religious nationalism, they're often contrasting themselves to a form of secularism. But when we say secularism, people often mean very, very different things when they talk about secularism. So it sounds like the model you're describing, right? You have these two majority nations, right? Pakistan, that is created as a majority Muslim nation, India, that's created as a majority Hindu nation. But then there's this tension, right, between the religious majority and this kind of secular state, and protecting the rights of minorities. And it sounds like India adopted, if we were kind of putting on a spectrum, something more close to the American model of the state having more of a neutral position towards religion, kind of an equidistant relationship to all religions, even as it allows for religious participation in politics, right? It's not trying to push religion out of the public square, but more to say, we're going to have a vibrant public conversation with protections for religious minorities.
I think that's a fair comment.
Should we turn now to talking a little bit about what the Hindu nationalist movement is, what ideas it's drawing on, sort of theologically and socially and politically? And I wonder if you can say, first, just tell us a little bit about what Hinduism is, because I understand it's something of a, it was under colonial rule that a lot of different kinds of Indian religious practice that shared some similarities, but were also quite different in different parts of the country, were put under this umbrella term of Hinduism. So if you can tell us a little bit about that process and what we're talking about when we use the word Hinduism. but then also share with us about what ideas from Hinduism Hindu nationalists are drawing on or practices.
I think it is more appropriate to think of what we speak of today as Hinduism as a family of religious traditions. As you know, the name Hindu itself is a geographical term. It has its origin in the name of a river that was pronounced differently by different communities. So Hindu is just a variation in the pronunciation of the name of the river that we know as the Indus River. So the term was used originally to describe, you know, communities inhabiting the vast territories drained by this river. So originally it represented a great deal of diversity. And, you know, the suffix Hinduism was later added on by missionaries because they found it very difficult to deal with the complexity and the diversity of the Hindu tradition. So they themselves started a process of homogenization in order to challenge and to respond to this tremendous internal diversity. Now, transitioning from that very broad statement to Hindutva, and Hindutva is the name, the Sanskrit term that we often speak of as Hindu nationalism. The first point I would want to make is that the term itself has taken on a lot of ambiguity. So I should mention Hindutva simply means in translation Hinduness. You know, you add the tva to the word Hindu and you come up with Hinduness. I go back to the foundational exposition of what Hindu nationalism is, although it has taken on many new meanings and is a constantly moving term. But the earliest, the work by Vinayak Savarkar, who wrote, he published in 1915, if I am not wrong, a small book called Hinduness. One thing we have to remember when we read his work is that he uses the word Hindu as synonymous with Indian. So he speaks of India as Hindustan, the land of the Hindus, but he's really speaking about a Hindu. He equates both the national and the religious identity. So he's trying to define who legitimately belongs to India and who is, by implication, who does not belong. So he says, first of all, a Hindu, and by which he means an Indian, I should say, is a citizen of India. Right? You, either in yourself or through your forefathers, you are entitled to Indian citizenship. Secondly, the second requirement of Hinduness is what he calls, and I'm quoting him now, common blood. You are a descendant of Hindu parents, and so you share this. He uses the word jati, which has a lot of resonance as well. But you have in your veins what he speaks of as Hindu blood. And the third is allegiance to a common culture that he calls Sanskriti. Sanskriti on the basis of his claim. Now, with those three criteria, his whole movement is to exclude Christians and Muslims. So he goes on to say their cultural ideals, their heroes, their spiritual teachers are from outside of India. They don't share Sanskriti culture, therefore they are aliens. They do not belong here. So the for him, the authentic citizens of India, the authentic Hindus are, you know, members of the Sikh, Jain, and Hindus, although he privileges the Sanskrit tradition above all other regional traditions. So he also moves the certain homogenization of the Hindu tradition. That's also a characteristic of, I think, of Hindu nationalism, to overlook the internal complexity and diversity of the tradition in favor of a homogenized Sanskritic-based Hindu tradition, which he uses to marginalize. So for him, Christians do not belong because they don't venerate India as a holy land.
So let me see if I can reflect this back to you and see if I'm getting it right, because I think this is actually a really, really important point. Is when we talk about religious nationalism, right? The nations are new, religions are old, right? And so people have these kind of existing identities, and then as you have the emergence of these nations and modernity, people start merging identities and start blending their kind of older religious identities with these more modern national identities. But that creates this deep ambiguity around definition. And we see this in the US as well, right? People say the US is a Christian nation. What does that mean? Does that mean it's essentially Christian in some sort of philosophical, ontological way? Does that mean it's a majority Christian nation? Does that mean Christians should be in control of the United States, right? All of those can be contained within that one phrase of Christian nationalism.
Yes, you are quite right. So the emergence of the modern state and how ancient ideas are seeking to affix themselves or to adapt to the emergence of the modern state. And one of the important characteristics of Hindu nationalism, which is really very new, is to introduce religion as a criteria of citizenship, of belonging to this new entity, this new state entity. You know, one of the important themes of Hindu nationalism, which is that Hindus have never been able to affirm and assert power in India because of internal divisions, because we are a divided community. And so part of the effort of him is to find what would be the shared basis that would be able to unite the Hindu community. So he comes up with his definition of Hindu-ness.
I find it amusing that there is within this vision a sort of anti-missionary religion strand to it, right? Anti-Christianity or Islam or other religions that have come into the country from elsewhere, as seeing them as a foreign influence that's not part of indigenous, native Indian identity and religiosity. And yet there's this alignment. You had said that it was a result of the missionaries that there was this idea of one umbrella of Hinduism that obscured the great complexity within the various Hindu traditions. And so there's this ironic aligning of the missionary impulse to homogenize the vast multiplicity of Hindu traditions and this arising Hindutva movement that is similarly seeking to homogenize or bring together the great differences and sometimes divisions within the Hindu traditions.
Yeah, it's really like Hindu nationalism is just us falling into the trap of identity that was laid out by the British when they came to India. If you look at the first British census data, which is conducted in the 1800s, when the British established power and the first multiple rounds of the British census, you had dozens of communities, if not more, which said that they were Muslim and Hindu, or Hindu and Sikh, or Sikh and Muslim, like which checked multiple boxes on the religious identity category. And these are like identities which have gone back many hundreds of years. South Asia has always been this fluid, this place of fluid religious identity. And then the British are like perplexed by this. They're like, no, you have to check one box. And this idea of one identity really is introduced and reinforced by the British system of governance. So there is this effort then from Hindu nationalists who see that, okay, there are other communities, there's Muslims and Christians and Sikhs, etc., who are clearly defined, who have their own idea of political leadership and are able to elect their own representatives, etc. There is not that same shared identity among a Hindu community. And yet, there's this anxiety that if we don't consolidate into a sizable enough block, then you will not be able to claim, you know, political power. And so Savarkar, when he's writing about the need to assert a Hindu identity, he very much is also saying we have to overcome caste distinctions and unite as a common Hindu umbrella. I mean, it's just so tied to capturing, you know, an electoral majority or a political majority in order to have political power. And that's the political context for why Hindu nationalists are so intent, even now, of saying that, no, all Hindus across castes, we're all one Hindu family. You know, we're all one Hindu community, and we need to consolidate against, you know, Muslims and Christians.
What the Hindu nationalists also seek to deny, you know, traditionally, the religious traditions of India, they never existed in isolation from each other. They didn't exist as fortresses, but they existed with very porous boundaries. And the history of Indian religions is full of the examples of such mutual influence and connectedness. The shrines of Sufi saints like Nizamuddin Aulia and Moinuddin Chishti attract Hindu pilgrims and visitors, you know, from India's diverse traditions. Muslims in the sacred city of Varanasi welcome Hindu devotees of Shiva with flower petals during the holy month of Sravan. I could give you so many examples of mutual interaction, mutual learning, enrichment. This is a reality of life on the ground among the traditions. But this has become problematic for Hindu nationalists.
This is the damage that religious nationalism has caused all over South Asia. I mean, this is the anxiety that Hindu nationalists have and right-wing Muslim extremists in Pakistan and Bangladesh have, is that the fact that this whole region, there's all these examples of a shared culture and shared identity. There's this effort to purge Indian culture of its Muslim elements, or to claim that certain Hindu traditions were polluted by Muslims, and now we have this opportunity to cleanse and sanitize them. It's very similar things have happened in Bangladesh. This idea that there is something called pure Hindu culture and pure Muslim culture and pure, you know, Sikh culture. That's the violence that Hindu nationalism does to Hinduism itself. I mean, this very monolithic one way of being Hindu, one particular really North Indian, upper caste, like, version of being Hindu that's centered really on Rama and Hanuman, these particular deities. Anyway, it's a flattening and monolithic kind of process which does so much damage to the Hindu tradition.
So there's this, you know, this problematic equation of Hindu nationalism with Indian nationalism. Even the movement to independence reflected these tensions. It was not a single movement, but people were in different places about the significance of Hinduism. And you had some leaders of the movement, people like, I would say, the Maharashtrian leader Bal Gangadhar Tilak, who brought a very, very strong Hindu symbolism to the struggle for Indian independence, which caused fear among Muslims. And Gandhi himself was, you know, predominantly Hindu in his own mode of being and his the symbols that he he brought. So even then you had this sort of fusing of Hindu nationalism and Indian nationalism. And now it has become, for the Hindu nationalists, it's become beyond question that Indian nationalism is Hindu nationalism. There's no other way of being loyal. What is under suspect by the Hindu nationalism, the loyalty of Indian Muslims and Indian Christians to the state. And therefore, you know, seeing the culture of Hinduism as the true religion, the true culture of India, everything else is alien.
But I want to move us into very kind of concrete terms. So I'm going to throw two acronyms and one name out there. And I want you to relate these for us. Help us understand how these fit together. So the first will be the RSS. The second is the BJP. And the third is Narendra Modi. How do those three pieces fit together in India today?
The RSS is one of the oldest and most influential Hindu nationalist organizations in India, with global affiliates across the world, or all over where the Indian diaspora has settled. The BJP is the political wing of the RSS, basically. It is the political party that is connected to and sustained by the RSS and its massive grassroots network across India. Narendra Modi is a lifelong member of the RSS from his youth on up till, you know, the present day. And he is a member of the BJP, and he is the Prime Minister of India. It heads the ruling coalition of parties, which is the BJP and many other political parties affiliated to it, which have been in power in India since 2014.
The RSS was founded in 1925 because of frustration with the non-violent political methodology of Gandhi. So the founder felt that the way forward was a movement of inner transformation by the creation of this organization whose members were completely devoted to the Indian nation. And you mentioned Modi, and as Nikhil said, Modi grew up through this organization. And in fact, left his family to dedicate himself fully to the service of India through the RSS. Gandhi's assassin, Nathuram Godse, was a member of the RSS, and some of the other RSS people, including Salvaka himself, were arrested and tried for conspiracy in the assassination of Gandhi. So the BJP that you mentioned is the political organization that ideologically brings into the political world the ideology of the RSS.
Can I add a couple points? First is that the RSS has been banned multiple times in independent India's history. So there have been moments where the government has declared it's a unacceptable extremist organization. There have been cycles, like after Gandhi's assassination, the RSS was banned. Later on as well, it was banned a couple of times. Right now, it is clearly not banned, and it is, in fact, one of its lifelong members is occupying the highest position in India. The RSS was also founded, like Professor Ramachand said, in the 1920s, and it was directly inspired also by the European fascist movements that were taking place at the time, particularly Nazi Germany and Mussolini's Italy. The uniform of the RSS, which its members wear and will parade in these marches, it's like white shirts and khaki shorts. These are not Indian clothes. Like it's a very specific visual identity. It's a very specific militant ideology that was, I mean, you have Hindu nationalist leaders openly writing about how they admired Nazi Germany. So the treatment of minorities in Nazi Germany was seen as aspirational for Hindu nationalists, a former leader of the RSS. And a few years later, in 1944, Savarkar was interviewed by an American journalist from the LA Times. This journalist asked that, you know, in an independent India, how do you plan to treat the Muslims, Mohammedans in the interview? And Savarkar says, as a minority in the position of your black population. And so if you think about that, in the 1940s, an American journalist asking, how are you going to treat Muslims in independent India? And Savarkar is looking at, you know, Jim Crow America and saying, we will treat them how you treat black people.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And let me see if I can describe this in terms of concentric circles. So you've got this broader movement of Hindu nationalism, right, that gets started in the 19-teens, 1920s, and then it finds kind of expression in this kind of RSS organization that kind of takes this bigger movement and kind of crystallizes it and channels it into a certain kind of political program that then gives rise to a political party, the BJP, that is expressing this, right? So it's the biggest circle is Hindu nationalism. The RSS is a smaller circle within that. The BJP is a smaller circle within that. And it sounds like at the heart of all of these circles, you could put Narendra Modi, right? That he is a politician with the BJP. He's a lifelong member of the RSS. He's devoted to the ideology of the movement of Hindu nationalism. But that he is one kind of person within this much more bigger swirling world of ideas and programs that in and of themselves, as Nikhil was saying, you can even point to connections to European fascism as part of the kind of root source of some of these movements.
The term that is used in talking about Hindu nationalism is Sangh Parivar, which means organizational family. And so the Hindu nationalist network is intentionally super confusing. I mean, it is like countless different cultural organizations, political parties, religious institutions, educational institutions, all like, I mean, it's just this like insanely complicated web of connections, which is really convenient for Hindu nationalists to have plausible deniability from when one organization does one thing.
As an expert on American Christian nationalism, let me just say, I find myself in the same boat with you, Nikhil, right? Like all these different organizations, all these acronyms, all these names, all these leaders, and some of whom will say they're Christian nationalists, some of whom won't, right? And it all becomes this jumble that when you try to point to it and say, this is actually a really concrete thing, well, you can get lost in the details. So people who might follow the news in India, even just at a distance, might be aware that these are not all just kind of political questions, right? These are real world communities that often come into conflict on the ground. And we've seen over at least the last decade in my awareness, maybe it's been going on even longer than that, a growth of a form of mob violence, especially against Muslim communities in India. And I wanted to understand, what's the relationship between this kind of superstructure, the RSS, the BJP, the Hindu nationalist movement, and this mob violence? And how does the government respond to these incidences of mob violence that we might see that are inspired by Hindu nationalism?
So in so many ways, it's not at all surprising, because the connection is so close. So many who study and observe the rise of Hindu nationalism would look back to the 2002 Gujarat riots as a very representative instance. And as you know, the Prime Minister was the Chief Minister of Gujarat at the time of that riot. Over 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed, with mass displacement, destruction of property, sexual violence. Even before that, 1992, the demolition of the Babri Mosque in Ayodhya, the tearing down of the mosque, which culminated recently in the building of the new Ram Mandir in the city of Ayodhya, which was rooted in a very violent act of destroying a mosque. These are just two very significant events of violence in the history of Hindu nationalism in India, with significant consequences for minority communities, because the demolition of the mosque sparked national violence with more than 2,000 people, I think, mostly Muslims again, who were killed.
For me, I mean, I grew up in the US. I did all of my schooling and education here. For me, as a teenager, to suddenly start seeing, around the time I was finishing high school, all of these news stories coming out of India about lynchings was a very... I mean, it was a very confusing and disorienting moment. I mean, in American history, we know, I mean, there's this long history of lynchings and mob violence, particularly against Black people, where the perpetrators had basically immunity, like there was no consequences for these sort of violence. And in India, especially since Modi took power in 2014, of course, there were incidents of violence against minorities before, but the pattern is that there has been this growing trend of lynchings. And so these are, it's just happening on a constant sort of stream. And the perpetrators of these attacks, the vast majority of them are not facing any legal consequences. And in certain incidents, the perpetrators of these attacks have actually been garlanded or felicitated by lower level, BJP officials and RSS affiliated organizations. But the other form of violence, which is very important to mention, is taking the form of social and economic boycotts as well. And so you have, especially in the last few years in India, these movements in towns and villages and in cities as well, where you residents will be gathered by some Hindu nationalist organization, asked to take a pledge that I will not buy from a Muslim storekeeper, shopkeeper. I will not give my money to Muslim-owned businesses. I think, American listeners can also resonate with the history of segregation and differential treatment in our country, but that is becoming incredibly pervasive. You have so many stories of how hard it is for Indian Muslims to rent an apartment in cities. The minute the realtor or the landlord sees the name and it's a Muslim name, it's incredibly difficult to find property in Mumbai or Delhi or these big cities. So there's the physical violence, which is ongoing, and the perpetrators are given immunity, but there's this larger social and economic exclusion as well that is really taking place in more frequency today.
Just to add to that list and to connect in some ways, India with the diaspora. Not long ago, during a Diwali celebration or Diwali parade in New Jersey, one of the items on the parade was a bulldozer. Many Americans were quite innocent about why you would have a bulldozer as part of a Diwali parade in an American city. But it was very deeply and with sinister purposes symbolic, because the bulldozer has become an instrument for the demolition of Muslim homes in many parts of India. This kind of violence is particularly connected with the chief minister in the North Indian state of Uttar Pradesh, Yogi Adityanath. So the bulldozer in the New Jersey Diwali parade carried his portrait, as a sort of legitimizing, justifying that kind of violence against the Muslims.
I think it was a India Independence Day parade, actually. So not, which is even more, imagine you're Indian American Muslim family in New Jersey, and you're going to celebrate Indian independence in this parade, and then you see this bulldozer showing up. It's one thing if it wasn't a Diwali parade, which is, you could say it's a Hindu festival, it's some Hindu organizations are organizing, but if it's a, you know, it's an India Day parade, it's meant to celebrate, you know, all Indians. This is a, you know, it just shows how much Hindu nationalism has entered the kind of mainstream Indian American spaces in the diaspora.
Can you expand on that a little bit? The role of the diaspora in Hindu nationalism and the role of Hindu nationalism in the diaspora.
Yeah, I think Nikhil used a good term recently earlier when he spoke about the Sangh family. So, which is a constellation of organizations with their parallels here in the United States. So in India, you have the RSS. In the United States and also in the United Kingdom, you have the HSS, the Hindu Swayam Sevak, which is the mirror organization in the diaspora, which is based mainly, particularly on Hindu on university and college campuses, drawing and attracting young people and disseminating the ideology of Hindutva. So it takes an organizational form, but I think that there are other ways in which I would say political influence and lobbying. Diaspora groups often representing the ideology of Hindu nationalism are often mobilized to lobby the government of the United States in favor of Indian government positions, very often anti-Pakistan, trying to get the United States to align with India as opposed to Pakistan. Other things that one might mention, Matt and Susie, would be, representing Hindu nationalism as an issue of cultural identity and pride. And for many younger Hindus in the diaspora, it's an appealing message. Be proud of the fact that you are Hindu. Be proud of your the roots of your ancestry in India.
The Hindu right in the United States and other countries often, particularly today, align with existing far-right extremist movements, particularly on this basis of an anti-Muslim, shared anti-Muslim agenda. And so in the US, for example, many Hindu nationalist groups have collaborated with organizations and individuals who are like flagged by Southern Poverty Law Center as, you know, as hate groups. If you look at Indian Americans in general, 69% were concerned about Hindu majoritarianism. So it's not that the diaspora is overwhelmingly, you know, Modi supporting and BJP supporting. It's that there's a very small but organized and wealthy kind of network who claim to speak for the whole community and align with other right-wing organizations.
So let's turn a little bit to the resistance strategies that are operating on the ground in India and maybe even among the diaspora. Nikhil, you mentioned that there's this way in which what you're seeing in India now resonates with some of the forms of segregation and violence that happened during the Jim Crow era in the United States. And of course, famously, Martin Luther King went to India in order to learn from the Gandhian nonviolent resistance movement, and that informed the civil rights movement in the U.S. and its strategies that were effective in pushing back against Jim Crow. And so I wonder now, we're fast forwarding and we're seeing India move in this direction that looks a lot more like the 1950s and 40s in the United States. Are there ways in which there's resistance tactics that are working, or lessons we can take from what's not working in India now as activists in America who are trying to protect democracy and to protect pluralism in the face of threats against it? What can we learn from how folks are pushing back against this in India?
Two most visible examples I would say, at least for me, one has been in late 2019 / early 2020, when the government had proposed a new way of defining Indian citizenship and an amendment to existing citizenship laws, which triggered a wave of protests across the country because they were perceived as anti-Muslim. The epicenter of this movement started in a working class Muslim neighborhood in Delhi. It was led largely by women of that neighborhood. There was a kind of a wildfire effect where across the whole country and in the diaspora, communities came together in a very visible way of asserting that all of us are Indian. And there was a very strong emphasis on the importance of the Constitution. But the Indian Constitution is a really important rhetorical tool for activists who are resisting Hindu nationalism. The Constitution is seen as a progressive document, as a assertment of a secular, all-encompassing Indian identity that is justice-oriented. In India, you have, you know, a leader will be leading the crowd in reciting the preamble of the Constitution, and that is seen as a really form of resistance. The CAA NRC protests, they really foregrounded an inclusive sense of nationalism. It was a assertment of Indian identity. It was this constant use of the Indian flag, of the national colors, of maps of India, and claiming that all of us are Indian. Those protests were only cut short because of COVID. I mean, it was like kind of a abrupt ending to that, but it was a really visible moment. Another important mobilization was the farmers' protests, which happened 2021-2022, and that, I think, speaks to just the importance of like working class mobilization. And you had farmers across northern India who congregated around Delhi and really, like, I mean, they shut the roads down. They brought their tractors and trucks, and it was mostly from the Sikh community, or there's a very high visibility of the Sikh community there in those protests. That had a huge material impact, and I mean, the Indian government did repeal these laws that the farmers were protesting. And so I think those are two moments that we could learn from.
I just will also want to mention, Hindu nationalists treat everyone who is Hindu and who is critical of Hindu nationalism as anti-Hindu, and by extension, anti-India. So it is so important that in resisting Hindu nationalism, we also reclaim the pluralist, inclusive Hindu tradition. But to invoke those people in the tradition, and there are so many of them, you know, many of the people like Kabir Das, Mirabai, many of the bhakti teachers of medieval India who reject this kind of nationalistic exclusivism. The whole movement to reclaim what the Hindu tradition means, and not to cede it over to the Hindu nationalists, is a very important part of this resistance. The second I would mention, I think there is a significant role for the academic community. And I would just give one example. In 2021, we had the important conference which we called Dismantling Global Hindu Tour. Now, you will know when something is important by the kind of resistance that it attracts. And this sparks such tremendous resistance on the part of Hindu nationalists, indicating a fear of, you know, of exposing the ideology of Hindutva. And the third, the role of the media and documentation, human rights organizations, journalists and filmmakers we have in India also, documenting many of the expressions of violence that we discussed, the lynchings, the demolitions, the riots, to keep the violent face of nationalism in the world's attention. So the media, the academic community, and as well the grassroots efforts to reclaim that tradition and those pluralist, inclusive voices are, I think, important as part of the resistance movement.
I think there's a really important need to think about coalition building and how to have a big tent kind of movement that resists, you know, various forms of religious nationalism. In the Indian diaspora and in India as well, there continues to be a level of discomfort, I would say, with faith, but particularly with where do Hindus fit in this like fight against Hindu nationalism? There's this idea that other communities, whether it's Muslims, Christians, Sikhs, Dalits, there's an important role that minorities have to play in these movements as leading the movement from the front. These are the communities who are most directly impacted by Hindu nationalism. But in order to uproot this ideology, you need to also have some way of including, you know, people who are Hindu, who identify with that label. And I think there is a deep discomfort and tension that comes with when secular progressive activists are having to you know, trying to fight religious nationalism, but not able to figure out how do you include, you know, the critique of Hindu nationalism from the Hindu perspective. And I think in the US, similarly, but to a lesser extent, actually, I think in the US there is more space for progressive Christians and Christians against Christian nationalism to be part of these coalitions in the way that I think the Indian diaspora and India can learn from a little bit. I know that there's still a lot of suspicion and tension about, you know, including Christians and particularly white Christians in these movements. But I think it's a issue that all of us have to still figure out. It's like, where is that role of people from that community speaking out against their own communities?
I think it's such an important point, Nikhil, because you know, if you recall that that Shaheen Bagh protest in India, it was initially started by Muslim women as a protest against the Citizen Amendment Act that we referenced. But then it attracted students, Hindus, Sikhs, Christians, and civil society groups. So it became a true grassroots interfaith solidarity movement. And I think that's really critical. Grassroots interfaith, as Nikhil mentioned, solidarity movement is an important way in which resistance must be carried forward.
Thank you both. This was excellent.
Yeah. Nikhil, Anant, thank you so much for being with us. This was incredibly valuable, what you offered to us. So Matt, let's begin by chatting a bit about the parallels between Trump and Modi, because I think we can put Modi in with this sort of pluralist fascist coalition that we've been speaking about of democratically elected heads of state who are aligned with religious nationalist forces and who are using similar tactics to erode democracy in their countries. Modi is in the club with Bolsonaro from Brazil and Trump and other leaders who we'll be meeting in coming episodes. Nikhil and Anant mentioned Modi's role in the 2002 Gujarat anti-Muslim pogrom. Modi was at the time the chief minister of this province, and he did little to stop the violence, as they mentioned. And then he went on to serve as the head of state, someone who was a card-carrying member of the RSS, a group that had been outlawed as an extremist group in India's past, someone who essentially oversaw a mass massacre of Muslims. What does it mean that these things were not a deal breaker? It echoes the inconceivability of Trump being elected after leading a conspiracy question about President Obama's birthplace, and then being accused of violence against women, and then reelected after overseeing violent separation policies at the border and attempting to illegally overthrow an election. They are clearly both charismatic leaders who have this strong populist appeal to racial and religious majorities that allow them to be elected after so many of these atrocious examples.
Yeah, and I think we just have to get our heads and our hearts around the idea as well that even in the most developed democracies, even in these places with the rule of law and all, there's a large portion of the population that is going to be attracted to these kinds of strongmen. And what they do, what these strongmen do, like Trump and Modi, is they approach the religious majority, right? We talked about this a little bit last time, and say, you're vulnerable. You as the majority, you're losing your culture, right? And this is where you get this majority with the minority complex that we talked about with Geetika last time, right? And so if you go to India today, there's all this talk about Hindu phobia in India, even though about 80% of the population is Hindu, right? And there's all this talk of anti-Christian bias in the US today, especially coming from our federal government, even though 62% of the population is Christian, right? It's absurd to think that in an actual functioning democracy, the majority is experiencing some sort of discrimination or persecution. But that is the appeal. And then the strongman promises protection for those communities and power to that majority, right? In Trump's first term, it felt like he and Modi were pretty well aligned. Trump went to India, and there was this huge rally there. And then Modi came to the U.S. in 2019. They had this big rally in Houston that I actually thought was pretty cleverly titled Howdy Modi. It was this big kind of stadium event that they did in Houston. Modi's one of the first heads of state to visit Trump in his second term, though it appears their relationship has started to cool a little bit in the first year of Trump's term. I think a lot of that has to do with the tariffs and some of the aggressive posture, but they're also both strongmen, right? And neither of them wants to appear weak. They both want to be the kind of alpha on the stage. I think one of the differences, though, is that for his whole career, Narendra Modi has really built his reputation, built his political career on Hindu nationalism. And he's been aligned with us even before he started getting into politics, right? So there's this very deep attachment to that for him, very strong ideology there. With Trump, I mean, he uses a lot of Christian nationalist and Christian supremacist rhetoric, but it's always hard to tell what he's going on inside of him. I will say, even though Trump is more of an opportunist, I have observed since the Butler assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania in summer of 2024, Trump seems to have adopted a much more spiritual rhetoric, a much more spiritual vocabulary, personal for him. So it seems like he has taken more of a sincere turn, at least on the surface. But with Christian nationalism in the U.S., I think it's less that Trump is a deep carrier of that ideology, but he has surrounded himself with advisors and staff and cabinet ministers who are very steeped in Christian nationalism. And I think that is more where the threat comes from in terms of policy. Trump is a little bit more chaotic and episodic and frankly greedy than that. But these folks, there are true believers inside the Trump administration in this stuff, and they are willing to push this stuff all the way to the wall. So one of the other things that I think we should talk about here is some of the parallels between the violence and these armed wings of these movements that we're starting to see. So as Anant and Nikhil talked about, the RSS is this like paramilitary movement that's aligned with the Modi regime. And then you also have in the US these kind of far right militia movements that are also kind of playing at this kind of paramilitary idea.
Yeah, and I want to jump in here and share an anecdote. So I have to admit that I was fairly naive about our far-right militia organizations here in the U.S. I mean, I'd read the reports from the Southern Poverty Law Center. I understood in theory their existence and their proliferation around the country. But it's a different thing entirely to confront it with your own eyes. And I did when I was in Charlottesville in 2017. I was there with a group of clergy who were responding to the Unite the Right gathering, the rally of far right white supremacist groups. Our group of clergy, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, we were gathered to demonstrate opposition and condemnation of those groups and their hate and to be a de-escalatory presence in Charlottesville that day. We were also a pastoral presence when the car attack happened and many were hurt and Heather Heyer was killed. In any event, there were many militia who showed up to that rally and they aligned with the right-wing rally-goers. They were seemingly there to protect them and to intimidate the counter-protesters like us clergy and Black Lives Matter activists. And it was chilling to see because they were very well organized. They were standing in formation. They were very heavily armed. They wore uniforms of their different groups. They had patches showing their rank within their groups. I don't think I'd fully understood until that moment that our militia in the U.S. are so well organized and trained, and they're ready to show up in defense of white supremacists. It was a really chilling moment for me.
Yeah, I'm sure. I track these folks quite a bit in my research. And I think it's useful to distinguish, because sometimes for American audiences, some of these terms might be a little bit unfamiliar. There's a real difference between military and paramilitary. So an authoritarian regimes use both. It's not like they're mutually exclusive, but they're used for different purposes. So the military, the army, the navy, the marines, they're used for fighting foreign wars. And in dire straits, maybe they get brought in for civil enforcement, but that's like the exception. So if we were thinking about like the Nazi case that many people are more familiar with, the Wehrmacht were the armed forces, the German military. But then you also have the paramilitary. And in the Nazi case, these would be like the SA, the AKA the brown shirts, or the SS, right? They're the interior enforcers. That's the paramilitary. And the paramilitary groups like the RSS in India or the militia movement that you're talking about, and by the way, the militia movement in the U.S. is almost entirely united around Trump, right? The Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and all these groups, deeply, deeply Trumpy and deeply into MAGA. But we also have an increasing paramilitary threat in the U.S. in the form of Immigration and Custom Enforcement, ICE.
Yeah, and right? The Border Patrol.
Yes, yes, right? So they're not military. They are not the army or the navy. These are more flexible groups, paramilitary groups. They sometimes operate within the law with more formal or somewhat official status, not military, but still official. That's what ICE and Border Patrol are. Or sometimes there's an element of plausible deniability, like with these militia groups or sometimes with the RSS. Some of the violence that goes on here is what we would call technically extrajudicial or more colloquially vigilante violence. In the U.S., we don't have a lot of experience with these paramilitary groups and movements in our politics, apart from kind of militia showing up at one of these big rallies or something. And often I think in the past, we've treated these paramilitary elements as kind of the fringe. But what's happening through MAGA politics right now, and especially the radical new deployment and utilization of ICE, is and then also these threats of the Insurrection Act that get talked about a lot, they're moving us more and more in a direction where we could see real paramilitary violence and enforcement inside our borders.
Yeah, it's deeply concerning. And there's two international examples I want to talk about with respect to this as sort of a warning. One is Nikhil and Anant mentioned that what gets called lynchings or mob violence in India, it's actually a form of paramilitary violence in the way that you're describing it, Matt. It's violence that's aligned with political and military leadership, sometimes in formal ways. The same thing happened in Sri Lanka. There was clear evidence of ties between the military and the mobs that were attacking Muslim businesses and communities under the Rajapakshas. And this has gone on for a long, long time in Myanmar, this use of paramilitary forces in the form of mob violence against communities. It may start out with informal ties, but then it becomes more formalized and organized as partnerships. And then the second example I want to offer is from Colombia, where I did some work at the USIP. And there was a lot of use of paramilitaries by the government as part of its warfare against the guerrilla groups. And I just can't overstate how much of a mess it has become for the country now in the aftermath of the Havana Accords and their attempt to create a sustainable peace there. Because they decommissioned these paramilitary forces. The Catholic Church was actually involved in some of that work to demobilize the paramilitary forces. But once they're out there, they're like gremlins. and they continue to proliferate, but in more unorganized ways that are, you're less able to control. And so they now operate as these informal criminal networks called Bakrim in Colombia that just harass the local populations and continue this form of informal criminal violence within the countries. It's really hard to undo.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that has me most concerned thus far into the second Trump administration, is when you get these paramilitary groups, right? Suddenly you're moving away from kind of the idea of like far right attacks into more organized violence. And if you want to see how this could play out and how this is already playing out in our politics, look at the January 6th pardons. Right? You had all these groups show up on January 6th. They perpetrated violence at Trump's command. There was a religious inflection to that. And most of the militias in the U.S. align with far-right Christianity. They adopt these Christian nationalist narratives. It was very much present on January 6th. They destroyed property. They threatened our democracy. And then they were all pardoned or not prosecuted. And what are those people thinking the next time we hit a crisis? Oh, Trump will protect us if we commit violence in his name. And that gives this kind of possibility for an escalating violence in society that you almost can't ratchet down in the short term.
It creates a permissive environment for violence.
Yeah.
One final point I want to make before we turn to start talking about the resistance. I want to underscore the point about Hindu nationalist influences operating in the U.S. You opened us with that, Matt. I saw this so many times when I worked in D.C. foreign policy spaces. You had lobbyists from groups like the Hindu American Foundation who were just omnipresent in these meetings. They attended events about India and disrupted them if they perceived them to be critical. They moved in religious freedom circles. They were often aligning with Christian groups who were espousing anti-Muslim narratives or targeting the policies of particular Muslim majority states like Pakistan. So members of these groups would express concern about Christian minorities in Pakistan, for example, and of course, Hindu minorities there as well. But then they would act defensively if the plight of Christians and other minorities in India was mentioned. But my point here is that as we examine these transnational alliances and influences, we can't overlook the role of Hindu nationalist advocacy in DC and how it has reinforced some Christian nationalist narratives and influences when it's convenient for them. And their influence goes beyond U.S. foreign policy spaces. So they're also influencing school boards and educational curriculum across the U.S., what is taught about Hinduism. They are resisting U.S. corporate policies that are seeking to eradicate caste bias among employees and corporations that have a large South Asian population and so on. And all of this is to say the U.S. is being shaped by Hindu nationalism too. And so all Americans have a stake in the work of resistance that's happening both in India and in the U.S.
Yeah, and Susie, you navigate these peace-building circles much more than I do, but just to share one of my own anecdotes, I mean, I think sometimes when you think about Hindu nationalism or Christian nationalism and just assume that these groups are out there declaring themselves as Hindu nationalist or Christian nationalist, right? No, they play word games around these ideas. And I was at a gathering with some journalists who specialize in religion a couple of years ago. And there was like a sponsored panel, a paid for panel by the Hindu American Foundation. And basically the whole argument of this panel was there's no such thing as Hindu nationalism. And this goes on for like an hour with quote unquote experts up on stage declaring all these things is that, no, this is just hype. There's nothing like this going on. And I was debriefing with one of the journalists in the room afterwards, and they made the observation to me that if this had been a panel about Christian nationalism, some of the journalists would have surely pushed back. But American religion journalists, because Hindus only make up about 1% of the population, are not that familiar with Hinduism. And so they just kind of let it pass. So even as they're already kind of ignorant about Hindu nationalism, this panel that was done ostensibly to educate them only contributed to and reinforced their ignorance. So I think when we talk about religious nationalisms, as we're seeing with Hindu nationalism and Buddhist nationalism and Christian nationalism. I think sometimes it can be an easy way to think that the solution to all of this is less religion, that we need to get rid of religion in society, that we need to move into a kind of truly secular state and completely move religion out of the public sphere. And secularism is a complicated word, but I think what we need is to recognize that within these communities, within these countries, the majority of the country identifies strongly with religion. So in India, about 80% of people in India identify as Hindu. And then you have Muslim minorities and Christian minorities and Sikh minorities in Sri Lanka and Myanmar. And I will also note that theological work can be quite dangerous because you start to get pushback. Oh, you're showing anti-Christian bias. This is the accusation that I'm sure many in the Trump administration would direct at people like you and I, Susie. Oh, this is anti-Christian bias. Even though we're Christian and we're speaking from within our faith tradition, it's not, they see it as insulting their version of Christianity, so therefore it's biased. And that's why people like Nikhil and Anant are really important. They don't live in India. But the Hindu nationalists might not even consider them good Hindus, but they are helping challenge these Hindu nationalist narratives from within Hinduism using scholarship and history and all of their own experiences with Hinduism and identities to anchor this more expansive and grounded vision of Hinduism that then can be itself a sort of antidote within Hindu communities.
Yeah, there's an incredibly important role for those within majority communities to challenge from within their co-religionists, those within their racial groups, and so on. We spoke last week about the interreligious and inter-ethnic solidarity that made Sri Lanka's nonviolent uprising a success. Sri Lanka, Myanmar, India, the U.S., we all share these similarities of being a diverse society with a clear majority. The nationalists have a pretty simple appeal in these societies. Unite the majority against the minorities. And so the center-left opposition, we can't play that game. We have to create the pluralist coalition. And that's going to mean two things simultaneously. The first, the role of those in the majority communities engaging their own people. I think of a monk friend of mine in Myanmar who has done this so well. He reaches out to fellow monks who are being drawn to the nationalist appeal to strengthen Buddhism. And it's an earnest desire that they have to want to strengthen and protect their tradition. But my friend brings them to his monastery for leadership classes where he engages them from within a Buddhist philosophical teaching to help them begin to question the nationalist anti-Muslim pro-military regime prescription for how to strengthen Buddhism. He calls these folks in. He's not necessarily reaching out to the extremists per se, but the sort of waffling middle of monks. And to good effect. That kind of work is necessary here too for us Christians to be calling in other Christians, especially those white, to be engaging theologically, asking like you did at the end of last episode, Matt, where would Jesus be right now? What would Jesus do? The group Showing Up for Racial Justice, I want to give them a shout out because they have some really great resources to help white folks do that work of engaging fellow white folks in ways that aren't about naming and shaming, because that just creates defensiveness and only entrenches polarization, but that are about expressing curiosity and calling folks in.
And just if people want a new vocabulary word, right? So we often talk about interfaith and inter-religious dialogue. This is intra-faith, intra-Christian dialogue, intra-Hindu, intra-Buddhist. And it's really important part of this work too, right? Standing up to your own community.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's harder, frankly, than some of that inter-religious work. But secondly, there is that inter-religious work, the solidarity work in multi-religious, multi-racial spaces and in public spaces, where multiple voices and ideas will be present, not just those Christian. David talked last week about the 1988 democratic movement in Myanmar and its weakness in being so Bamar Buddhist dominated in its leadership and narrative. And that alienated folks like David, who are ethnic and religious minorities. It reinforced their fear of Buddhist domination, even among those fighting for democracy. That's an important thing to keep in mind. The Christian theology and narratives critiquing Christian nationalist and supremacist narratives are critically important, but they're not sufficient in themselves as we seek to build a pluralist vision of national identity and belonging. That needs to be co-created with the pluralist coalition. And Nikhil's illustration of the anti-citizenship law protests in India were, I think, a really powerful example of that. Defending the Indian constitution and its pluralist vision of the nation, celebrating the diversity of India as a place that always has been home to such religious diversity as its heritage and a source of pride, uniting the people.
If you're interested in learning more about Hindu nationalism, we have some excellent resources that were recommended by Nikhil and Anant in our show notes. If you'd like to know more about Nikhil Mandalaparthi, who is now a PhD student at Emory University, you can find him at nikhilmandala.com. You can also find Anant Rambachan, who is an emeritus professor of religious studies at St. Olaf College and is very involved with interfaith efforts in the Twin Cities area. He's at Anant Rambachan, spelled ANANTRAMBACHAN.com.
And join us next week when we're going to be traveling to Israel and Palestine and exploring two different types of Zionisms, those found within Judaism and Christianity. That's it for this episode of American Unexceptionalism. Thanks for joining us.
Please hit subscribe and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
You can keep up with this show and all the other great series from Axis Mundi Media at www.axismundi.us.
This show is produced by Andrew Gill and engineered by Scott Okamoto. Funding provided by the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the International Center on Religion and Diplomacy.
Until next time, remember, the struggle for democracy is global, and we aren't alone. वो दिन के जिसका वादा है जो लौहे अज़ल में लिखा है हम देखेंगे जब ज़ुल्म सितम के कोहे गरा रूए की तरह उड़ जाएंगे हम देखेंगे
Have you ever heard something like, you should be ashamed, just for being your true, authentic self? Then Teología Sin Vergüenza might be the place for you. We are queer, trans, feministas from Latin America and its diaspora who aren't ashamed of our faith or our activism. Our weekly conversations offer a space for reflection, analysis, and spiritual reclamation as we try to navigate home, faith, familia, and identity. So grab a cup of coffee. Whether it's café con leche, café cubano, café de olla, tinto, chorreado, or americano. Join us for the deep dive into the lives of theologians, elders, activists, and everyday saints as we talk about decolonial faith, gender justice, sexuality, and sacred resistance. I'm your host, Reverend Sex. And for all of those who feel like you aren't enough of this or too much of that, ni de aquí, ni de allá, you belong here. Join us for shameless faith conversations about real life right now that you won't find anywhere else. You might just realize that you are a sinvergüenza too.